Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and CBS News Middle East correspondent Clarissa Ward is in New York to receive her well-deserved DuPont Award for her courageous reporting from Syria. And we are delighted that she is giving us some time while she's here. Clarissa, thanks so much for coming on WNYC today, and congratulations on winning one of broadcast journalism's highest honors.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me on the show.
We'll review some of your reporting in Syria, but first let's talk about what's happening there right now. The latest series of headlines is a growing humanitarian refugee crisis across the border in Jordan. Are many, many Syrians fleeing there?
Many, many Syrians are fleeing. I mean, according to official statistics, there are about 600,000 Syrian refugees who have left their homes inside Syria for the sanctuary of refugee camps in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. And that's just the official statistics. Also not included in those numbers are the 2 million Syrians who are still inside Syria, but who have been forced to leave their homes because of the violence, because of the lack of security, and the situation for them is really desperate, because that desperately needed aid, while it can get to those camps in Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan, it's much more difficult for international aid organizations to get that aid into Syria.
The fighting, from what I read, inches ever closer to the seat of power in Damascus. Do you see the end of the Assad regime coming soon?
Been a lot of speculation, and indeed on behalf of some people perhaps breathless speculation as to when the regime will fall. I think everybody needs to not necessarily expect, at least be prepared for the possibility that the Assad regime may not fall as quickly as people would like. The French foreign minister saying something to that effect today, that there are no real signs that the fall of the regime is in fact imminent. Of course, they're under a great deal of pressure, both militarily from sort of bold and brazen attacks from the rebels, and also economically. The country is really at a standstill. So while there's a significant amount of pressure on Assad and his regime, there isn't yet a sign that we may be getting closer to the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak.
Listeners, if you have any questions for CBS News foreign correspondent Clarissa Ward, who's been in and out of Syria constantly over the last, I guess, year and a half or so, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. It's tempting to take our eyes off that situation when other things are going on in the world, and it seems from our vantage point to be dragging on in an ambiguous way. But this is one of the great humanitarian crises, one of the great political crises in the world today. And we invite your calls for Clarissa Ward if there's anything you want to say or ask. Any Syrian Americans also welcome to call in and chime in. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Clarissa, in all the Arab Spring countries, the question of who replaces the old line dictator is complex. But in Syria, with different groups of rebels, maybe it's the most complex of all. Can you tell?
Absolutely. I think this is the real problem that the uprising or revolution has faced inside Syria, is that there is a real lack of communication and coordination among the rebels. And also, indeed, there's not really a cohesive structure that binds together all these different groups with all of their disparate interests. And as a result, you often see on these on the ground that these groups are, in fact, working at cross purposes, in some cases even fighting each other, all of them pursuing their own strategic interests, and often at the expense of the sort of greater cause, so to speak. And I've really seen that in recent months, where the sort of more extremist radical Islamist groups have gained a lot of traction on the ground, precisely because they are more organized. They are more disciplined. They are not prone to the same criminal activity, such as looting, that we're seeing from some of the other more secular Free Syrian Army groups. So it's really compounded, though, this lack of unity between all of these groups, and that, of course, makes it much difficult to push closer to some kind of a military victory.
And with the news from Mali and Algeria, there is more talk of an Al-Qaeda threat in the American news media than any time in years, I would say. That's a big reason for the Obama administration not wanting to arm the Syrian rebels all through the last year, that we may be arming future enemies and we can't tell. How much Al-Qaeda do you see in the Syrian rebel movement?
I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda is a difficult word to say specifically this rebel, is a member of Al-Qaeda. Perhaps he, takes some inspiration from them. But just coming back to what you're saying, I think it's really a chicken-egg situation. And if you speak to Syrians about, okay, why are you letting these extremists come into your country and why are you allowing them to sort of hijack your revolution, in a sense, and the answer you will get over and over again is, we reached out our hand to you in the U.S. We begged for the help of the international community. We were inspired by the West. We were fighting for democracy. And it's precisely because you didn't help us and we were dying that we had to turn and reach out our hand to someone who would help us. Now, I'm not saying that's 100% the case. I'm just saying that's the argument that they make. So there's an argument to be made that the rise of extremists, in fact, in Syria is not a reason that we shouldn't be helping them. It is, in fact, a product of the fact that we haven't helped them by allowing this chaos, this void, this vacuum to go unfilled. It has, in fact, left the door wide open for more extremist non-state actors.
John in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Clarissa Ward from CBS News. Hi.
Hi there. Calling to ask, since you've been, as you had said, all over the refugee camps, I'm calling on behalf of somebody who I know won't be listening because of work right now, but if she wanted to volunteer, or rather she wants to volunteer but doesn't quite know where to go to help out in one of the refugee camps, what most needs the help, what is there any organization you would recommend contacting?
Mm-hmm. Do you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can tell you a couple. I mean, depending on in what capacity your friend would like to be involved, there are some really amazing organizations that Syrian Americans have set up to try to help with this desperate humanitarian situation. One is called the Maram Foundation, M-A-R-A-M, and it's just, I believe, maramfoundation.org. They are running one of the biggest camps just inside Syria, where that aid is having a really tough time getting to these people, of 12,000 people, and that number is going up and up every single day. That's one organization. Another organization is SAMS, the Syrian American Medical Society, I believe is what it stands for, and they are doing incredible work sending Syrian American doctors inside Syria because, of course, the people who are being hit by artillery and airstrikes every single day, most of them don't have access to state-of-the-art hospitals and the field hospitals that they are able to seek treatment in are so desperately short of much-needed supplies. So those are two organizations that I can think of off at the top of my head that are really doing fantastic work and are really, really desperate for funding.
One of the reasons you won the DuPont was your reporting earlier in the Syria war when you snuck in as a tourist. Can you tell our listeners when that was and what you did?
That was in November of 2011. I had been traveling to Syria many times when I lived in Beirut in sort of 2008, 2009 time. But I knew that I wouldn't be able to get a journalist visa to go there now that as the uprising was starting to unfold. So I applied for a tourism visa. I was lucky enough to get it. Unfortunately, the crew who I was supposed to travel with were not able to get one. But I decided anyway to go ahead on my own. I took a very small sort of point-and-shoot camera that I figured would look inconspicuous. Already, I was very conspicuous. I'm 5'10", blonde hair, the only tourist in Syria possibly at the time. So I spent a few days on the ground trying to make sure that I wasn't being followed by doing normal tourist everyday activities. And once I'd ascertained to my satisfaction that I wasn't being followed, I then I put on like a headscarf that covers all of my hair. And I went and lived with a Syrian activist for a week. And during the course of that week, he took me to the funerals of people who had been killed. And this is in the days, you know, I think we forget that at the beginning of this uprising, you know, Assad's regime was not yet dropping bombs from the sky. There was no artillery being used yet. This is in the days when peaceful protests were being met with bullets. So I attended the funeral of a 16-year-old boy who I was told had been shot by security forces while attending a protest. I attended protests on Friday, which is the Islamic holy day and the traditional day of protest throughout the Middle East. And I was able to get a sense of how this operation or how this uprising was manifesting itself and of the incredible bravery of these networks of young activists and indeed many of them just ordinary Syrians who were willing to stand up and face those bullets in order to speak their minds and fight for the democracy and freedom that they believe they deserved. Obviously, the revolution or uprising, however you may categorize it, has changed a lot since then.
And you've been back to Syria, what, five times since then?
I've been back many times, yes. One starts to lose count a little bit. I went back in February, almost a year ago, and I was the first U.S. reporter to go live from inside Syria with rebel forces. And that was really, I think, the first we'd seen of who were this Free Syrian Army, this band of rebel fighters, and what kind of a fight were they engaged in. And you quickly saw that these men lacked any formal military experience. They did not have proper communications equipment. They had, they were woefully undersupplied in terms of weaponry. And so it was clearly, going to be a very tough and bloody fight. They were no match on a military level for the regime. And, of course, the regime began escalating more and more, starting to use artillery, starting to then deploy its air assets. And, indeed, in some cases, literally throwing huge barrel bombs stuffed with TNT out of the back of a helicopter and, sort of with a devil-may-care where-it-lands attitude.
Clarissa Ward, CBS News correspondent covering the war and the humanitarian crisis in Syria, 212-433-WNYC, and Antoinette in Hackettstown. You're on the air. Hello.
Hello. You mentioned prior about the diversification or the diverse interests of the different rebel forces. I was just curious as to what you thought could unify them and if there was anything the international community could do other than what they've already done to help in that process.
Well, I think what the international community has tried to do is to isolate the rebel groups or rebel leaders and opposition leaders who it sees as, the most, who it sees as not being at odds with its strategic interests and its security interests in the longer term going forward. But what the international community hasn't really done yet is to really support in a financial or military way one particular group, which might therefore give them the traction they need on the ground to rise above other groups and say, okay, here's the deal. I'm the one with the weapons and I'm the one with the money. And so, we all need to unite under my umbrella or this umbrella organization. Now, there's a lot of reasons not to arm the rebels, and one could argue that, leadership needs to come from inside. And once a leader emerges, then perhaps the international community could get around that one individual or one group or ideology rather than sort of forcing it from the outside. But certainly it's made it very difficult. And I interviewed recently the leader of the new coalition of Syrian opposition forces and also the new, ostensibly the newly elected leader of the Free Syrian Army. And both of them told me that they had been promised a lot of money by the international community, by the U.S. and the West, and that they hadn't so far that money hadn't been delivered. And in their minds, what they are grappling with, trying to understand, is we're the ones who espouse these secular values that you espouse. We're the ones who are concerned with ideals of freedom and democracy and women's rights and minorities' rights. Why aren't you doing more to empower us? And so, you know, that's been a real difficulty that the opposition has still seems to be waiting for some kind of outside help, except for those who have turned and embraced the extremists.
Sonia in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sonia.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I read somewhere, I'm not exactly sure where, I think it was maybe McClatchy, that there was a State Department memo detailing the use of gas on a small number of refugees, that their wounds were consistent with gas uses, but I haven't seen that anywhere else. Have you heard of that?
And this, of course, has been one of the lingering questions, you know, possible horror of the Assad regime using chemical weapons that they apparently have. So, Clarissa, what do we know?
Well, there was a case, and I'm sure it's the one that you're referring to, where it appeared that some form of chemical weapon or gas had been used in an area in sort of near the Homs area of Syria. It was never really, to the best of my knowledge, fully revealed exactly what the gas contained, or it did not appear to be lethal. As you said, I think it just created injuries. But of course, it's a huge concern. The Assad regime has a pretty extensive chemical weapons arsenal, and the question or the fear that many people have is when and in which case or in what scenario might the regime be willing to use those chemical weapons. On one level, it to me seems a little unlikely that the Assad regime really needs to use chemical weapons at this stage, because it is able, for the moment at least, to contain the rise of the rebels. And also, I think the Assad regime is very well aware of the fact that that really might be the line in the sand for the international community. And if they did use those weapons, it would almost certainly lead to, some type of action from the international community, which so far they've actually really been able to evade. And if you talk to Syrian people on the ground about the issue of chemical weapons, it's quite interesting, because while they're clearly concerned about it, they are being bombarded from the skies, from tanks, from snipers, every single moment of every single day. They are dying by the hundreds, indeed by the thousands. So they don't really make the same distinction of, oh no, what if they use chemical weapons? Because as far as they're concerned, the slaughter is already ongoing, and whether it's done with a bullet or a tank shell or a bomb or a chemical weapon, for them is, I think, more semantics. Now, obviously, if there was a devastating chemical attack, that it could potentially kill tens of thousands. So, it would represent an escalation. But their point more being that don't just wait for chemical weapons before helping us.
My guest, Clarissa Ward, covering Syria for CBS News. We have a few minutes left. Why do you do war reporting? What drives you to risk your life to get the story of this war?
I would love to say that it's heroic notion of wanting to help other people, and certainly perhaps that's a part of it. But I think there's a real privilege, an incredible moment that happens when you're able to travel to different countries and meet different people and connect with different societies and witness history in all of its brutal and bloody but also beautiful incarnations. And in the case of Syria particularly, which is certainly a story I have felt more passionate about than most stories before, I would say there's also a very real sense that if we aren't covering it, those of us who do continue to cover Syria, because of the incredibly dangerous security situation, that nobody will cover it at all. And that, to me, is my greatest fear, that people will forget that, more than 60,000 people have been killed in Syria since this conflict began. And incidentally, 90% of those casualties took place in 2012. So it's not, you can't think of it even as being spread out over 2 years. Mm-hmm. We're talking, huge amounts of people dying.
And this includes some journalists dying, as Syria has proved a very risky place from which to report. As a frontline female war correspondent, did you have any reaction to the announcement yesterday that the Pentagon will allow women on the front lines as troops?
Well, I mean, certainly, yes. As a frontline female war correspondent who spent a lot of time with the U.S. military, of course, I'm pleased to hear that women who choose to engage in combat are in a position to do it. And, you know, there are so many incredibly brave female soldiers and Marines and sailors, and also so many you talked about, you know, the dangers for journalists inside Syria. And I just, you know, I can't tell you what a terrible year it's been for the journalistic community inside Syria, losing the incredibly brave and vivacious and talented Marie Colvin, losing Anthony Shadid, who is perhaps the greatest writer on the Middle East, and even those who haven't been killed. For example, my good friend Austin Tice, who is a freelance journalist working for McClatchy newspapers and for the Washington Post, and who disappeared on the outskirts of Damascus in August, and also James Foley, who was working for the Global Post and Agence France-Presse, who disappeared on Thanksgiving Day in northern Syria. And I could go on and on and on. I really can't emphasize enough, you know, what an enormous cost the journalistic community has paid for its, you know, ongoing commitment to cover this story.
And one of the reasons that you won this Columbia DuPont Award for going back and back and back. I'm just curious if you see women in Syria through your reporting as holding any different views in general about the civil war than men, or in different percentages, like being more anti-war or less interested in factions or anything, or is the Syria situation too far gone for any differences like that?
I think the Syrian situation, you know, the crisis in Syria has passed a point where it really is very polarizing. I mean, you know, you're kind of with the regime or you're against them. Now, that said, that's what you'll hear from people on the ground. But you talk about women. I'm fortunate as a woman. I have a lot of access to women. Whenever I go to anyone's house, I'm invited to sit with the women and the children, which my male colleagues don't. And when you talk to the women, you do get a slightly different sense. Not that, you know, there are any less, the women who I would be covering who are with rebel fighters, that they're any less against the regime, but that they are tired of the violence, that they are tired of being permanently afraid. I met women who had not left the house in a month because the aerial bombardment was so intensive. And I do think there is a swath of Syrian society who look at the way the regime has behaved and they feel sickened, and it's clear that the regime has crossed every single red line. But then they also look at the rebels and they see how disorganized they are. They see increasing cases of humanitarian, you know, breaches of humanitarian law going on the rebel sides too, and looting and other such sort of petty criminal activity. And they're the sort of people who are just frightened and they don't really have a voice. And I think all they're looking for is a swift resolution to a conflict that has already taken far too many lives.
Well, CBS News correspondent Clarissa Ward covering Syria and having just received one of the most prestigious, if not the most prestigious award in broadcast journalism, the DuPont, given by Columbia University. Thank you very much for spending a little time with us today and giving our listeners such deep background on what's going on there. I hope we can continue talking, and be safe as you go back.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I love your show.
Thank you. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Love 2.0, Beyond Looking for Romance.